Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Something Rotten podcast. It is our third episode on Disco Elysium, and that means that we have actually gotten to all the same point in the game, finally. We've finished the first day in episode one, we finished the third day in episode two, and now I have no idea how many days it took Blake, but we have reached the end of the confrontation in the town square, meaning there is just a little bit of the game left. Blake, third episode of this, how are you feeling?
My God, almighty Jacob, I'm feeling great because sideways to the Disco Elysium conversation, if that's the main track here, this is a side conversation we're having. We're having a micro kill screen reunion on this episode, a Dead Bert reunion here, which means I'm where I have always wanted to be back in 2017. So I'm very, very excited today. The game is fine, I guess. It crashed a bunch on me. I don't know. What do you want? I wore a jacket with a really awful name on it. I mean, come
Hell
on.
Hell yeah.
It's great.
Well, look, usually I introduce everyone, but Blake, you want to introduce your former coworkers?
Absolutely. We have Josh Calixto, formerly of Killscreen, but also of the Bad End Podcast, writer at where at this point? What you wrote for Kotaku? Were you at Pitch doing stuff for Pitchfork? Take it over.
Yeah, I did some music, mostly like K-pop slash culture stuff, like MTV News, Rolling Stone, a bunch of other spots. And now I'm mostly doing podcasting at Bad End and video stuff at Super Culture Video.
Hell yeah. And your own Disco Elysium podcast.
Yeah, Savoir Faire, Disco Elysium podcast. That was like a short run podcast as well, similar to this one.
And then also joining us, Maddie Chilton, former writer at Killscreen, but also Bullet Points and Unwinnable now. Like, we're both columnists together, I believe. I've been a columnist for 2 days.
Yeah, so. Boy, Unwinnable. That's really mostly what I do. I write for Unwinnable, and I fuck around on the internet, and I read tweets.
Hell yeah. This is Jacob, two of my favorite writers in the building. I'm a little flustered, nervous, and excited all in one.
Me too. I mean, the thing that has become increasingly apparent doing this Disco Elysium podcast, and Josh, I'm curious, having also done a Disco Elysium podcast, is that it feels impossible. Like, every episode we have talked for so long, and then we finish it, and I immediately think of, like, 40 things that I meant to talk about and didn't. Or, like, I wrote down this quote, and I was like, oh, what a good piece of writing, but you can't just spend the whole podcast reading good quotes, because that's, you know, just play the game at that point. Did you feel the kind of insurmountable nature of this game when you were covering it?
Yeah, I think one of the other big parts was, you know, just the fact that a lot of the meaning of the game and what's happening in the game can vary drastically depending on how you kind of played through it. Like, what happens in a given scene or situation is so much different, and like the takeaway of what that might mean in the larger context of the story, it's drastically different. So it's difficult to discuss some of that stuff, but I think as long as you kind of pay attention mostly to the thematics of what's going on and some of the bigger takeaways, that's what made it easier for us. But even then, yeah, it does feel impossible in a lot of ways.
I feel like in these book club formats, like, you're supposed to get lost in the weeds of any game, and Disco Elysium is the one where it's like, I feel like we can't. It would be 8-hour conversations every episode if we decided to talk about every fucking conversation we had.
But also, kind of, the whole game is weeds.
True,
you know,
yeah,
it's like, no matter what we're talking about.
Also,
we're
you don't know you're in the weeds 4 hours. Like, yesterday I was like, surely this is the end game. Turns out I was just in a very long side quest.
Maddie, assuming that you have not also done a Disco Elysium podcast that I'm not familiar with.
I have
with,
not.
What is your, what's your history with this game?
I wrote about it before it came out for Killscreen, when it was under a different name. The studio was under a different name. And then I forgot about it. And then it came out and, you know, I covered it when it came out. And it's just been one of those games that I'll forget about it for a while. You know, I'll be like, all video games are great. We love everything here. And then I'll go back to Disco Elysium and be like, this is fucking insane. What happened here? How did we get here? It's just, man, I was replaying it for this and thinking, how did anyone do this? How did it's such a small game, like, physically, you spend so little time walking around more than two city blocks, and it's still so, you can't talk about it all. It's just everything.
I'm really curious about your pre-release experience, which I assume was many years ago, so you don't need to remember it specifically. But the original title was like No Truce with the Furies.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. It was something with the Furies?
No Truce with the Furies.
Yeah. Who did you talk to?
I didn't talk to anyone. I just covered a couple of blog posts that they had made covering the development. Okay. But this was really early on. The studio was going by Fortress Occident, and I guess they had just been, I don't even remember where they were posting these development updates, but Chris Priestman at Killscreen found out about it and was like, somebody please cover this. And so I wrote about their dialogue system. They had written about the skills. And I got a Facebook message from one of the marketers. And they were like, we're so excited that you covered this. We're so excited to like get more press. And it's crazy to think of that getting to where it was now, because at the time it was just a weird passion project by a group of Estonian avant-garde like weirdos in Tallinn.
Yeah, it's definitely one. I mean, it's like, it is obviously there was some pre-release coverage, but like my memory of this game is a total just heard one person mention it on Twitter and then heard like five people, and then it was just that, like, you know, complete word of mouth was at least how I experienced it, where like I never saw an ad for this game until it was already released and they were advertising like the director's cut. You know, it just seemed like it released and purely through force of the game itself, people started talking about it.
It really did, yeah. I don't think that... I almost think it's kind of a fluke that it didn't entirely fall by the wayside, because I think with the kind of game it is, there was such a chance that it really wouldn't hit. But of course, people recognized what was going on was so cool and so clever and inventive.
I think about that often, of like how many games release, and it's like, is there a Disco Elysium level game that just doesn't have a marketing budget, and none of us will ever see it because it just gets like lost in the 10,000 new games on Steam every day?
That's depressing to think about.
Blake, last time I feel like you gave like here are the big five or the big four things or something that you want to talk about. Do you have those for this? Because there's definitely some stuff that I've been waiting to talk about, but I'm curious how you did.
I did an important thing at long last. Now, look, folks at home, I don't know too much about the decomposition process of the human body. I assume by the time I did that autopsy, was not the freshest cadaver in the joints. But on day five, I finally did the autopsy. It was fine. I think the big takeaway was I found the bullet in the back of the man's throat. I stuck him into a refrigerator, and Kim was like, don't tell anyone we did that. And I was like, that's a great moment. And I found a bullet in the back of his throat.
That's pretty... Well, okay.
Sorry, I think just died outside my window. It's the highest pitch noise I've ever heard.
New York City, baby. You say you did the autopsy. It's fine. I would say this is one of my favorite bits of video game writing ever. I like the autopsy might be my favorite part of the game.
Sorry, what I was kind of getting at here is the autopsy up until the moment we ended was the what I felt was a careful house of cards I was building slowly starting to fall apart.
Uh-huh.
And the autopsy, I was like, great, I did it. And then over time, you learn like how wrong, at least I have been in my investigation, by very nature of I had to kind of desecrate a corpse to find something in the back of his throat because we missed it in the initial autopsy. So things are where I started to really feel like a dummy cop. Does that make sense? Does that happen in every playthrough?
It does.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Jacob, tell me why you love the autopsy so much.
I mean, I think that it is this kind of amazing coming together of like all of the tones,
sure, yeah,
that the game is working with all at the same time in this kind of amazing way, where it's like on one level it is so bureaucratic, where you have this form and it's like you're gonna fill out every, yeah, single box on that form even though you don't have the information for most of them. So it's like birthday, it's like we don't know, but it's like you're gonna be asked birthday and then you're gonna write like NA.
Yep.
And so you're doing this, there's this amazing moment very early on where Kim does this like kind of ritual over the body before they do the autopsy, and then you get the, like, the kind of a spirit decor flash of, like, all the other cops all over the world doing that over other bodies at the same time, and it's this, like, moment of connection where it's like, here's a dead kid, and, like, a cop is doing the same ritual over it.
And it also tells you, like, how many are dead in Revachol that day or something, which is kind of interesting, because I think it's, like, 44 dead bodies today.
Yeah, and it is also incredibly grotesque, like, the descriptions of, like, the, like, bubbles of rot coming out of his throat are so, like, in-depth. And then, on top of all of it, Kuno and Kuno S are just losing their fucking minds, yelling like, oh my god, he's gonna fuck it, he's finally gonna
They're trying
fuck
to see
it.
That corpse's dick the whole time. It's such a good bit.
I did want to ask, we have a long-running bit, Josh and Maddie, on Something Rotten, of categorizing how many video games have penises in them, because as you might know, there are a lot of video games with female nudity in them, not as many with penises. Does this count? Because you don't see it, but you certainly talk a lot about the corpse's dick.
Yeah, does a representation via text of a penis count as a penis? That's a good question. That's philosophical.
I say it doesn't count.
I'm gonna go with no. I'm gonna go with no as well.
I think no.
Cross and Disco Elysium off the list.
He's wearing underoos, so no.
There are a couple of my favorite moments. There's the they're the thing where you're looking at the bruises on the body and Kim's like, okay, it's stones at low velocity because Kuno was throwing stones at it. And then Kuno's like, those stones were at maximum fucking velocity. And then you have the option of writing down like maximum velocity. Yeah.
Something I like about Kim in this moment, because I feel like the deeper, at least in my playthrough, I don't know what he's like in yours, Jacob, because you're playing a monster in your playthrough.
That's correct. Josh and Maddie, I am playing, unfortunately, a fascist Revacholian nationalist. Not a good time.
I'm playing a good guy. Because you're like trapped in Harry's head the whole time, like you feel like very impassioned towards him, and like I'm playing him as a very passionate person. And over time, Kim has become more like personable to me, that doing the autopsy, he goes like back into cop mode. And it was like kind of jarring to me, because I forgot that was a big part of his early character, was seeing him just like shut the outside world down. Like he's not trying to fucking joke around with you, which made me in turn like stop wanting to do little funny comments and be like, all right, yep, just writing it down, nod head. Like it's interesting to see him play those two sides in this.
Yeah. What are y'all's our illustrious guests, do you remember the first time you got that body down? I mean, was it early or late? Because I got it down on like the second day by hitting the like shoot the body down prompt, which I was shocked by. But if you don't do that, it takes a while.
Oh no, that body hung there for ages.
Same for me.
And I fucked up the autopsy bad. Total mess.
You can fuck up the autopsy?
I just learned nothing, and I think I pissed off Kim.
The worst like, thing you could ever
nothing
do.
Nothing went
this game.
Well. Yeah. My first playthrough was such a mess. And you know, it so was my second one. I don't think I've ever made Harry get past that first day stage of, oh god, who am I, where am I? I'm gonna die pulling my tie off the ceiling.
What happens if you don't find out anything during the autopsy?
There's a lot of other ways to arrive at the same conclusions, if I remember correctly. But you can also, there's a couple checks that like Kim had to brute force, because Harry will just have a existential crisis in front of the Hardy Boys for 20 minutes.
Yeah, that was one where like I found that bullet very early. And then you can present that to the Hardy Boys, being like, hey, do you know that this guy was shot? And they're immediately like, and their whole story kind of falls apart. And so it's one of those, like, you know, it really boosts your chances of kind of intimidating them if you get that. But if you don't, you can still just kind of pump points into that skill.
Yeah, it's funny because that part of the game was so memorable to me because I had done so little of that and had to do so much running back and forth, and just like you're literally running up and down stairs talking to one person and then bringing information to another person, and it makes it feel so comedic, and also it really drives in how much of your quote-unquote cop work that you're doing is just like, please dear god, tell me one sentence please.
Yeah, and I thought it was funny that Blake, you brought up that you felt like a cop who kind of knew what you're doing, because for this whole first section of the game, I felt like really anxious that like I was playing as this character who didn't seem to care about like solving the case as much as just like figuring out what was going on with himself and stuff like that. And just kind of trying to figure out what exactly was going on around him. And so like the more I failed things, the more I was like failing checks and failing to do like everything that was on my journal, I was like just continually starting to freak out. And Kim was kind of the only thing kind of keeping me tethered, because he's the only one who kind of knows what's going on. And I think that's what I really dug about this autopsy scene as well, is just like Kim is such a standout character. And this is another one of those moments where he gets his kind of chance to step forward and be like the consummate professional of the group.
Blake, when you found that bullet, what'd you think? I mean, because this like completely contradicts the narrative of the murder that you had been hearing for like the whole game, right?
Yeah, well, first I thought, wow, the description of him pulling this bullet out is the grossest shit I've ever heard in my life.
It's unbelievable. So disgusting. Like how far you go into it. It's like you reach through his brainstem. Yeah,
it's awful. On the one hand, I was like, God damn it, I gotta walk up that fucking whirling and rag staircase so many more times now, which on the Switch, man, it just takes forever to load a new location. I'm like, fuck. On the other hand, I don't know. I mean, there's like, I'm so into this game, despite it like not being my genre at all, that I was starting to like get a little bummed thinking it might be over. So a new red herring or whatever, being like, let me sink my teeth back in. Time to go detective mode. It made me question the possibility of staging a murder that well, which I guess it tries to explain, but that's very pedantic. To just be like, how did we miss a bullet in this dude's fucking face? But nevertheless, I was excited by it. Point being, like, I was excited to like keep going, to like keep folding things back. Like, I didn't want this whole thing to end at this point. I was worried the autopsy would funnel me right into the end game.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, do you have... this is not really a like an Agatha Christie novel where you can figure it out before the characters do, but like, do you have any theories on like what happened to this guy?
I thought I did. I thought I had a theory day one, and then I thought I had a different theory day two. I've had a different theory every day, and now I'm about to beat this game and I still don't know who killed this poor fucker. Like, this poor dude. No, I have no clue. I will say, one of my favorite Kim moments does happen at the end of the autopsy, at least where I found the bullet. I don't know if you can find it in other ways, but I stuck this dude's body in a refrigerator and did the rest of the autopsy there. And when you go through, like, I nailed all the checks in that moment and, like, got through it. And Kim, who has been, like, very kind of clinical this entire time, he's talking to you and he's, like, just saying some normal cop shit. And then the game says, and one more thing. Breaks the quote. He looks you in the eye. Great work, detective. And I screenshot it so hard. Like, it was my...
That's your friend.
Yeah, it was such a good moment. Because he's very sparing. I don't feel like he's ever said great work to me in this entire game. And it's cool the way a game makes you really feel that. I feel like any other game, I'd be like, yeah, I did my objective. It's easy. Games are stupid. Like, Kim is like the first character I'm like, I impressed the guy. It was cool.
I will share some of the opposite direction things that happened with Kim during my playthrough later, which equally made me feel as bad as that made you feel good. But so last time we basically talked to the Union boys and we talked to Colossia and kind of were interviewing them back and forth, and then. What I didn't remember is, like, there's a whole kind of second round of interviews after that, where you then, like, you know, you get her story, and it contradicts the Hardy Boys. And so you go back down, and you confront them with that, and then you find out, like, more stuff that kind of contradicts Colossia or whatever. So, like, Blake, have you... Did you get to the place where it's like, do you want to arrest her or
yeah,
not?
Yeah, and I didn't. Arrest her.
Okay.
I feel like Colossia has been just playing everyone in this, myself included, and yet there was still that part of me that, like, could not bring myself to, like, pull the trigger on her. You know what I'm saying? Like, the character is so well written that it's, like, even when I know she's playing me, I want to like give her every shred of sympathy, and I couldn't bring her in, and now she's gone, and I feel like a dolt.
We talked a lot last week about how good the kind of when the skills, or it's like when Volition realizes that all of the other skills can't be trusted around Klaasia. And then there's a moment later on where you realize that she lied or something. And it was specifically Drama in my playthrough that like realized it had been fooled and then turned around so hard and was like, you gotta arrest her right now. She fucked with us. We're so mad. Did y'all arrest Klaasia? Did you let her go? I arrested her, but I was just playing the shittiest cop, and so that's why I did it this playthrough.
I let her go.
Yeah, I've never arrested her.
Yeah, I think the game does a great job of giving you that, and then making you feel like maybe you screwed up for not doing it.
That's exactly, that's how I feel. Like, I feel like an idiot. When, I'm jumping ahead, but when we get to the end of the section, and they're like, by the way, she left town. I was like, son of a bitch.
Yep, like, that's the moment where you're like, oh no, I should have done a cop thing for once.
Yeah.
But I think you spend so much of the game not trusting in your cop skills, at least for me. I was like, I know I'm nominally a cop, but I don't want to, like, I should not be making decisions about people. And so I just kind of, everything I went in with, like, I'm probably wrong, but, and then you kind of run off after Ruby, and so once you get back and you realize, oh no, that was the time for decisive action, too late now.
I think the other thing is that like, the more over the course of the story that you kind of see the constant swinging back and forth between like this bureaucratic process of everything being so buttoned up, like with the autopsy, and then these other sequences where you're just doing shit by like the seat of your pants, like as when you're going back and forth between these people and like interviewing them, it just feels so janky. You're just like, okay, well, we just figured out something else. Let's go talk to those guys again. You're literally running back and forth.
Yeah.
And then so I think in that moment, it was kind of easier for me to make a decision that just feels right, you know, inside, despite having kind of evidence to the contrary, despite feeling kind of in your gut that something might be off here. I think the fact that, you know, maybe you fucked something up in this process, it doesn't feel as bad because like everything's kind of screwed up. And I think it, as long as it feels right, it feels like the right decision. And I think that's where like a lot of people end up landing on this section in particular. And it's kind of where I ended up in my playthrough.
I totally agree with you. And I think the game knows you're going to play it that way. Cause like, if you were a real cop, you would have arrested Klaasia, but like it knows, except in Jacob's specific case on this playthrough, like you're going to play it as a normal human who
normal human is doing a lot of work in that.
Yeah, right. But like you're gonna play it as like a person who is like, oh, I like my characters in this game, like I like Klaasia, or I kind of like Titus, even though he's a fucking asshole. It's like, if they were like, arrest Titus, I'd be like, well, no, that's my bro. Like, I just like talking to him.
Also, as I found out, if you try to arrest Titus, he will kill you. He blows your head off.
But I feel like the game knows you're going to like play it like an RPG, obviously, and have the characters you like and don't like. And so like turning the Klaasia arrest on you at the, you know, during the shootout is so smart because it undermines everything I had been building towards as a character. It was like a Harry with passion, like compassion, and wanted to care about people. It's like, well, she left town. What are you going to do about it, dumbass? You fucked up.
There's also the sense, but like the police apparatus is kind of the most unknown of the things you've got at that point in the game. And so because you're a cop who doesn't know what being a cop is like, sending someone into that scheme that you maybe knew about at one point but now have no memory of, and your reference for the cops is just Kim, who is an uncommonly good and like even person, it feels a little bit damning.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, as much as Klaasia has kind of been lying about everything else, you get the sense when she talks about like what being arrested will mean for her, it's like she's not making that. She's like,
for sure,
I will disappear into this bureaucracy forever, and then the people who want to kill me will be able to like use the fact that I'm there to kill me.
And that comes back with Ruby later, right? Like, it's, she's afraid of cops for kind of a different, specific to her reason. But like when you talk to her, it's like, oh, like she would obviously rather take just shooting herself than dealing with like who you are and the system you come from. That is like very compelling.
Yeah.
in a terrible, awful, scary way.
As a more general question, I don't know either of you super well. I feel like I can assume some of your feelings on the cops in the real world that we live in. When you were playing this game, were you kind of trying to be... Were you trying to be a good person? Were you trying to be, like, a good cop? Did you kind of run into conflicts between those two things? Because I personally, I think that the game is very good at kind of setting up, like, a cop would do this, but maybe I shouldn't do that because I don't like the cops.
For me, I wanted to be maybe not necessarily a good person, but someone who wanted to be a good person. And then kind of everything cop related was kind of in the background of that, like trying to be better first and then like doing my job kind of second, which is kind of, I feel like that's how the game frames the cops in this in general, is like they're not this institution that has the same amount of power as cops in the world that we know today. Like, in fact, they seem to be like way behind even like the unions as far as the power structure is concerned in this world. So it didn't seem like something where like it was really important for me to do my job well. I think like at the end of the day, it was about like being a good cop, quote, in the sense of the word of like what would a good cop be if there were good cops, and not just like someone who follows the law to the letter.
Yeah, and you start out with having to remember that you're a cop in the first place and having to piece together those parts of your life. So there's no, like, the character, unless you make him deeply believe in the cop work he's doing, does not necessarily. So the first time I played, I was sorry cop, and I just played the whole game being like, I don't know why I'm here. And that did not lend itself to being particularly authoritative or like, I just wanted Kim to tell me what to do the whole game.
Yeah.
I think one of the things, and this is something that former guest Noah Caldwell-Gervais mentioned in his video about this game, but like one of the really clever kind of anti-video game things this game does is like we're so used to kind of the best option in a game being kind of, you know, either like the Paragon option in Mass Effect or like kind of the, you know, I'm just going to be like a good centrist and I'm going to like try and make everyone happy. And by doing that, then I'll kind of like get the best of all worlds. And this game both relentlessly makes fun of you for that, you know, like going centrist will get you completely lambasted by the game. But also like it doesn't work, you know, like you don't get the best options by trying to make everyone happy. You kind of end up just getting like played by everyone and you really need to make some big decisions in order to make anything happen here.
I mean, it's kind of like what I was getting at with the Clausier stuff, but I feel like when I first started this game and I was like, I'm going to play Harry as someone like in recovery and blah, 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 blah. Like in my head, I was like, well, I'll play the platonic ideal of what a cop should be, right? And the more I played the game as someone with like compassion, by the time I'm where I am now, I feel like I've been a bad cop. Like everything I thought I had like learned and done right is like really kind of fallen apart on me. And it's like, well, what is the game saying at that point that like someone who's playing with compassion ends up being a bad cop? Which I think is interesting because it only hit me today as I was like ruminating on my playthrough. It's like, well, I fucked up the whole cop portion of this game because I wasn't like the strong arm of the law when I should have been.
And fascinatingly, I have actually found, though, being a fascist is bad for almost every aspect of the game, like it has given me a lot of cop skills that I'm able to use pretty effectively. Like my authority being super high has been like very useful, and like, you know, my various physical abilities, pain threshold and half light and whatever being up there means that I've been able to like pass some of these things that when I was playing as a more, you know, empath Harry, I was not able to get by nearly as easily. There's some fun stuff with Titus that I just wanted to talk over before we move on. After Clausier reveals his lie, you can go down and you're like, man, women are crazy. That's what I said in my playthrough. And he fist bumps you, and the fist bump is so powerful that it heals your health.
I got that too.
But then there's this kind of interesting part where you do realize, like, the kind of latent hairy consciousness is good, where the union guys are talking about, like, you know, I've heard of you, like, you are this person who just kind of, like, twists everyone's words against each other and, like, manages to kind of crack them open like a can opener. And it's, like, it is this moment of, like, oh, your reputation kind of precedes you. But then he said, well, so I arrested Clausia. Titus was like, I can't believe you did that. I said, fuck with the sun boy, get burnt. And Titus is like, God damn you, sun boy. Like, it's very good. Blake, did you do the church quest?
I did. Yeah, because when you go to sleep at one point, you get a voiceover.
When you go to who?
When you go to sleep at some point.
Oh, okay.
I heard bleep.
Yeah, so did I.
No.
Like you're censoring something.
No. When you go to sleep, one of the voices tells you to check out the church. So I did, thinking it was going to be very important to finishing this section. And instead I found Egghead, my arch fucking nemesis.
Baby.
Yeah, so first I found the kids in the tent. I don't even know how you would describe them. Uber fans of
the hardcore guys.
House music.
So yeah. Hardcore.
Yeah, they're really something else. And then the church. Jacob, Josh, Maddie, someone is going to have to walk me through what is going on in this church. Because I was lost by this scientific anomaly in here.
It's a hole in the world. Don't worry about it.
I mean, that's what I'm worried about, is I'm not sure I did the hole in the world. But yeah, to answer your question, I did all of this.
And how did you resolve it? Did you, because you can, like, you can have the ravers not come in and just be a research lab, or you can have it just be a rave place, or you can kind of marry the two.
I married the two, which was not really the solution I wanted, but, like, the mm-hmm. only way I could figure out how to help Sunya, the scientist yeah. in there, who's also affiliated with the radio RPG crew, which I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah, she was like one of the game
Yeah,
heads.
My favorite plot line is coming back, which I thought was awesome. She needed a better sound system to hear the lack of sound, which I thought was kind of funny. So my only solution was to, like, get the kids involved. So I had to, like, be the liaison between the two, being like, okay, like, y'all are just going to coexist for a little while, then they're going to take it over as a club. I would think I would have rather just left it to her. I was not really, like, a fan of the kids and their whole plan, but that was the sacrifice I had to make, I suppose.
Well, there are several elements of this we can talk about. First, because you weren't super into the kids, I feel like I know the answer to this, but did you dance to the music?
I nodded my head. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I did a little head
did
nod.
Did you get Kim to dance?
No, I wish. I wish.
This is one of the best checks of the game, is if you get in there, you have to do, I think it's maybe even a whole different side quest where you're, like, gathering sound recordings yeah. for them or whatever. But you do that, you get in, you feel the electricity of the music. You start dancing, the other guy who's not Egghead is dancing. I can't remember what his name is. But, and then you can order Kim to get on the dance floor, and it's like an authority check. And Kim is like, I did some years in juvie. And then Kim starts dancing, and he has, like, a very different dance style than you do. And so it's like you all learn to dance at, like, different places. It is amazing. It's really, really
I'm
good.
I'm sorry, Kim did time in juvie?
Well, he worked in juvie, I think,
okay.
is the
you
implication.
You can understand my confusion.
But he, like,
yeah.
he, like, knows what the young people dance like. I think he literally says, like, I'll show you age inappropriate or something.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I do think the whole hole in the world, though, plot line, embarrassingly enough, flew over my head. I wasn't entirely sure what was going on this whole time.
I think that's fine.
I don't have a deeper question about it, to be clear. Like, I just completely missed me what was going on there.
I think this is our opportunity to talk about the Pale,
sure.
which is
yeah,
one of the
baby.
Kind of biggest plot points of the game that is not really relevant to the mystery, yeah, but is vital to understanding the world. So last time I kind of pushed you to do the like derealization skill. Did you talk to anyone about the Pale? Because you can talk to like Joyce about it for a while.
I want to say the first time I had heard about the Pale was from, I guess, Suna. I think Ruby was the first one I actually asked about it. That's the only like conversation prompt I can remember about the Pale.
Oh yeah, because she's at the Pale compressor.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then there's the Pale driver, who's one of the like truck drivers who you can talk to and get a little bit.
Is that the old lady?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But I guess this is one of those, as we said before we started recording, ask five different people in the game. You get five different meanings of this. Maddie, what is your impression of the Pale?
I think I understood more of it just going back and watching people's playthroughs for this than I ever did when I was playing the game. Because every time I played this game, I've, you know, missed loads of it. And I had never gotten the Joyce conversation, which is basically the one place where it kind of ties stuff together. But, you know, it's like interdimensional transport, but also the matter of existence, but also kind of a cancer on the world. And it just gets to be all of those things. Uh-huh. But there's also the bureaucratic stuff tied in it, with Joyce talking about civilians get 6 days of Pale travel, but I get 22. And I think it's very this game, how they've taken this essentially like unmaking matter of the world that surrounds everything and also just made it like a little bit of a bureaucratic nightmare.
Right.
Like they've legislated it into not being impossible in the way it was.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I guess I took Joyce saying that as kind of almost like she was talking about like a diver getting the bends, where mm-hmm. she's like, I'm a little better at handling it. But you're right. Also, it's just kind of like, well, the government said she could get more of it. My favorite description of it is she's talking about it. So it's, Blake, it is like, it's kind of like between continents, there is just this void, like this kind of absence of space. Mm-hmm. And you can travel through it, but like everything gets really fucked when you're traveling through it. And it's like, you can't like live there. Yeah. You have to kind of be passing through. And Joyce, and I think some other people almost refer to it as like the rarefied past. Like it is actually like the history of the world turning into this bizarre swamp that is then, and one of the other terrifying things that you learn from Joyce is like, it's growing. Like there is more Pale. It is kind of consuming the normal world. And then the other thing that she says, which I don't think I got in my previous playthroughs, is she says the shape of the world is a fractured sphere. And so it's like, you know, if you think of our world as a normal sphere, you know, it's like it is somehow like the world itself is like broken open, and then the Pale is coming out of it somehow. But then in the church, you realizing that there is a piece of the Pale in the church means that in some way, like, that is going to take over Revachol, because there is no way of containing it. So it's going to grow and grow. And so it's kind of apocalyptic. It's kind of like a climate change thing of like, you know, the world, the thing that is going to destroy our ability to live in the world. But it's also this weird, like, the lens of history and nostalgia overruling what you can view as the present. It is an incredibly kind of nebulous concept.
It really does feel like it's a very complicated way of saying the past eats the future. And like the theme throughout the game of being unable to escape from the things you've done and the person you were in the history of the world around you. But they have all the stuff about if you send messages through the Pale, you'll hear memories or other people's conversations. And they've figured out this way of building a world around it and through it, and also it might eat all of us one day.
I I'm embarrassed to say I think I completely missed the pale in my playthrough until I hit Ruby.
It's easy to miss. It's very easy.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you talk to the crab guy in the church?
I did. Yeah. And his whole shit was fucking confusing to me too. Like, I had no clue what was going on in there.
Well, because he's so interesting because it's like he is this like maybe the most truly religious character that you meet in the game.
Based on my understanding, he's hanging out next to the pale piece, right? In the church?
Yeah, so it's like basically he's getting
paled up.
If you want to frame it negatively, brain damage from like being so near the pale, but he's also like, I found God and they're in this church.
Is this also the part where you find out about Dolores Day and all that jazz?
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's what I wanted to ask. What is the former religion of the church then?
This is where I also like, I when it comes to what are the like the innocents, this is where I got kind of lost because I'm like, these people are obviously very important in the past, but they're kind of tied in inextricably with the pale. They have these kind of supernatural qualities. Dolores Day is described as being like the most beautiful woman to have ever lived. It was very hard for me to tell like what exactly was going on there, what they might have meant in the larger context of things. I think later there are a few suggestions as to that. But to me, they took on this just kind of symbolic placement in the world where I didn't really understand the world building and what they actually meant. But like they kind of symbolize these kind of past figures who have become deities in the minds of the average people, but might not have been the best people in the world. And maybe were even normal outside of that. I don't know. That was my read on it, which is to say not a full read at all.
Yeah, it's really hard. And it's like there are people who know this kind of the lore much better than we do. We might even have one of them on next week. And so I don't want to kind of get things wrong, but it's like Dolores Day is playing this role where she's like, she is the most well-known innocence, according to the Disco Elysium wiki, and an innocence is the highest category of historical personage in the world, a literal personification of history. Traditionally, an innocence, when anointed, assumes supreme rule over the Occident or known world in general. And so Dolores Day is kind of like, she's like the primary figure of like moralism, which is kind of this game's version of centrism, kind of, and she's like, you know, she is almost like a king or like a royalty in a way. She's kind of elected. She's kind of
She felt like Pope to me because she's like infallible, essentially. Like she kind of becomes this doctrinal figure that they make it sound like the whole world follows. But then if you follow that Dolores Day conversation, there's also the part about someone doesn't respect her authority, so she wages war, and she has this army of humanity, implying the people they're waging war against aren't part of humanity, which may or may not like be something she's able to physically do because she's the innocence. They never make any of this clear, but it's such a great just like encyclopedia conversation I think you can get from that mural.
And then, of course, the other reason that you can't see any of it clearly at all is that Harry is incapable of seeing her and not seeing his ex, who, you know, it's like, who, like, I don't know how much you've gone into these conversations, but it's like one of the real routes you can take Harry down is like extremely broken ex-wife guy.
Yeah.
And like Dolores Day just becomes that. And they kind of, they're like filling the same role. And so when he's thinking about Dolores Day in history, he's also thinking about like his ex-wife. And so you like can't get any real answers out of him.
Yeah, I've had the ex-wife start to pop up occasionally, but never to a point where I've been able to like dig further into it. Like it'll be like a line, like a very quick line. My brain will tell me like, oh, you remember her hand on your face or whatever. I haven't got any choices to dig into it.
Maybe this might be answering this question. Did you dial a payphone in this run through?
No.
Because you can call her, and it is harrowing conversation.
That's a good conversation.
No,
in a bad way.
I assume I missed my chance. I'll have to YouTube that. No, where is the payphone?
It's like it's kind of in the like rundown, like the second area of the game.
Okay.
It's near some of the boardwalks.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, Maddie or Josh, you want to talk about that conversation?
I don't remember it super well. I just remember having to stop the game after that because I felt
same.
I tried to avoid most of the ex-wife stuff on my first run through because I thought that was going to make Harry's like psychological problems worse.
Oh, sure.
But I think, I don't know. I kind of wonder, I don't know how much Final Cut changed about the actual content of the game, but I feel like I ended up seeing more of it when I played the Final Cut.
That's interesting. Yeah, the only thing that I like know for sure is added is like the political vision quests. My guess is that they did add other stuff. But I definitely got this my first playthrough as well. And it's like, you're standing at this playthrough, and it's just one of those things where the game doesn't really encourage you, but it doesn't make you stop either, where you're just like, dial a random number, dial another random number, dial another random number. And you do that enough times, and eventually there's a skill check, and you kind of dial, and she picks up. And all the voices in your head are like, oh god, oh fuck, like immediately. They like all know it's her and are freaking out. And there's no good route through the conversation. You can't like pass it well. You are only going to screw it up.
So what happens? I'm not going to be able to see it in my playthrough at this point.
I mean, it's hard because like not really anything happens. You can kind of say like, I miss you, or you can say various pathetic things to her. And she's always like, well, Harry, I don't know if you should be calling, you know, she's like being nice,
yeah,
you know, but is it just kind of very uncomfortable with someone who's, you know, presumably terrible ex just called her unexpectedly.
It's like the Marvin's Room phone call from the Drake song, you know? Yeah. It's got the same vibe.
Go into this more.
It's got the same vibe of like you're on the phone with her and she doesn't really want to be there, and
yeah.
Meanwhile your stomach's kind of dropping in the same way that it happens when you kind of rediscover some of what happened during your bender. Like, I don't know if you saw the car.
Yeah.
Okay, that whole sequence as you still slowly kind of realize what happened in the past and what that implies about your present, I think is that catches up with you in a big way on this phone call too. But not many words are exchanged. It's just like very clear that, at least to the player, that she doesn't really want to be there.
My like reading on Harry's life pre-disco, I feel like has changed so much throughout the game, because like when you start the game, you're just like, oh, he is a disaster who has always been a disaster. But by the time you, like, find your cop records and, like, Kim walks you through what each of them mean, you're like, was I a good cop? Was I ever a good person? Was I ever normal? And then I always started to wonder, I am a recovering alcoholic. I know you don't become an alcoholic in a week. You know, that is, like, a gradual process. But I started to get the sense that, like, his getting to the point in disco was an escalation that happened very quickly. Like, it all just, like, hit and fell apart. And prior to that, like, he was holding it together. But by the time I talked to Ruby, I was like, was Harry evil? Like, because she starts talking about, I can't remember the character's name, but it's like, it's clear.
La puta madre.
Yeah. It's clear, despite how good your cop record might look, Kim being like, oh my god, you only killed 3 people. That's pretty good. Like, it's clear you were corrupt. Like, a woman is so scared of you, she commits, in my playthrough, she commits suicide rather than be further interrogated by you. And, like, trying to just have a grasp on who Harry was pre-disco has been, like, this constantly changing thing in my head of, like, maybe he was good. Maybe he was the worst man on earth. Maybe he was okay and it all just kind of fell apart in a week. Back to now, I'm like, Harry, you better hope you never regain your memory.
Blake, did you, I think we mentioned, did you get the little door open in your ledger?
No, not
speaking
yet.
Speaking of the ledger?
No, I forgot
okay,
to do
that's,
that.
That's something that I think you still can do.
Okay.
It's like, that's, you know, you should just be able to do it. But I do think we can just talk about it at this point. There is essentially a Silent Hill-esque letter in there.
Okay.
Like, from your ex.
Okay.
Who, says, like, Harry, I wanted to write you a letter so you can read it when you wake up. Maybe it will make you happy. You know, you have a vast soul, and I will always, always, always come back to it. Like, it truly feels like you are getting a letter from Mary.
Yeah.
And it knocks Harry out. Like, literally, he falls unconscious when he reads it. And it's, again, one of... I think people are mixed on the X stuff because it is sometimes, I think, a little hard to decide where this game, you know, it's like I'm giving this game maximum credit, and I'm thinking the kind of like a lot of the like latent misogyny in Harry thinking about her is because of Harry. You can maybe read it as it being like the game's philosophy on X's, but I don't think that's a very fair way of doing it. But like, I really went into the X stuff on my first playthrough of just being like, I'm not doing drugs, but I am mainlining memories of my ex. And it, like, I think it honestly works as a better, being someone who's doing a bunch of drugs in this playthrough, I actually think going really hard into your ex works as a better addiction metaphor than the actual drugs this game. Yeah. Because, like, it damages you more to think about her than it does for me to be, like, doing speed all the time.
I think in this section specifically, like, especially in the context of the church, what's happening in there, it's like they all kind of go hand in hand, where you have the pail, which, as Maddie mentioned, is this kind of this compacted material made of potentially the past. And then in the same church, you have Dolores Day, who's kind of like this embodiment of history in herself. And then you're talking to your ex, who for Harry is that on like a very personal level. I feel like a lot of the themes in this game, again, are how you can't really escape the past and how they like determine what happens in your present. And the X metaphor for me and what's happening with Harry all ties in with that. Like all these like really metaphysical and impossible to understand concepts, they all kind of go hand in hand for sure.
Yeah, it's like the past swallowing you.
this is actually a kind of interesting segue into, so I did not get this, which I was disappointed by. I had to watch it, but the political vision quests added post release, like for every kind of main, you know, communism, neoliberalism, whatever, you get kind of this quest that you can go on. My guess, Blake, is the thing that you heard about in your dream was actually the start of one of those, though I'm not sure how it would work, because I think that's where it's like when you sleep on day 3 or 4 or something, I believe that's where the vision quest opening is delivered to you, I will say, just quickly, playing through this game with specific goals in mind is actually very frustrating because the game has so many different things that can lock you in or out of options that, like, it's way more fun if you don't know what you're looking for and you just happen to stumble into things. But, like, when I was trying to play through this in a specific way, I kept like, missing the opportunities to do that.
While I was in the church, the big, I guess it's a picture of Dolores Day or whatever, like Harry did like genuflect at one point and get like very spiritual.
Uh-huh.
Was that any part of that vision quest?
I don't know. Because I've only done one of these now, and it's the fascist one. But the fascist one, you get obsessed with turning back time, and you keep going to basically all of the racists in the game and being like, do you know how to turn back time? And they're all kind of like, I don't know what to tell you, buddy. But bizarrely, there is a truly bonkers conversation with Measurehead that you have, where Kim
with Measurehead,
Kim's, yeah,
believe it or not,
Kim is like, I don't want to hear any of this, and so you talk inside like the office, which is apparently Measurehead's mom's office, while he stands outside. But like, there is this kind of amazing moment where Measurehead says a kind of remarkable line, where he says, I'm going to share a secret with you. Here is the secret. There is no love in the past, only the present. The past is made of static images, distorted memories, demented nostalgia. This, the present, with all its possibilities, innumerable hits and misses, is far superior. It is a living organism. And it's like, that almost feels like the thesis of the game.
Yeah.
It's delivered by the fucking phrenology guy. And then if you keep talking in that conversation, you can talk for so long about how Measurehead is practicing semen retention. And that comes after that. Oh, no. Anyway, the end of the fascist plot line, it literally changes your portrait. Like, you get this weird kind of sun behind you the same way that Gary the crypto-fascist has. And you keep saying these lines like, I'm the icebreaker. I'm, like, breaking through the ice. And you go to Kim, and Kim is like, are you okay? And you talk to him a little bit, and you say, I'm the icebreaker. And Kim yells, are you fucking insane, at you? Which is, like, his biggest break in the game. And then your internal thoughts are like, suddenly the whole icebreaker thing just feels kind of stupid. Like, he just, like, deflates your fascism in, like, one line. That's very funny, even though I would not recommend being fascist in this game.
Before we move on to the next Tinpole event, can I talk through some freaks I've met out in the world?
Oh, baby.
Well,
yeah.
I met Fuck the World and the other guy, whose name I can't say. They're yep. very funny. Fuck the World, especially. They want to be Skulls, which are this big, bad, scary gang in the game. You meet... What's the Skull you do meet? She's the artist?
Cindy the Skull.
Yeah, Cindy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you do meet some of them out there, but these guys are... hopeful to be Skulls, but Fuck the World. So Skulls are people who will, their silence is so scary because they will just kill you without saying a word to you. But Fuck the World is scared of confrontation. And so when you're like, give me your jacket, his friend is like, no. And Fuck the World's like, all right, man, just give him the jacket. I'm sorry, I just don't like confrontation. They run off. And then I made Kim wear the jacket with the awful word on it, and then there's a funny dialogue section you get later after the shootout where you talk to Kim about taking his other jacket off, which I thought was great. I also met the secret group of studying communists in the apartment building, which is just two guys who are kind of annoying. Huge fan of those dudes. You walk in and they're building something out of matchbooks, and at one point your internal monologue just tells you, it looks like they were trying to build the most unstable structure they could. Which I thought was very funny. And then you talk to them and they're just talking shit, and you're like, all right, man, yeah, I'll come back and read with y'all later, and I'm not going back to talk to those dudes. They were super lame. So those were my freaks for this section.
My guess is that you did not, because I think you have to do the Everart quest where you basically convince people to build a YMCA.
Oh, yeah.
In the slums.
I did not do this one.
That's how you get back your gun.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a shame that it's such a ludicrously evil feeling quest that I would guess most people are just like, I'm not going to do it, because it results in meeting one of the most interesting characters in the game for me, which is this woman named The Pigs, and she's who has your gun. Josh or Maddie, have you met The Pigs?
No, I never heard of her until you sent that message. I was like, what's this? Oh shit, that's the gun I never got ever.
I did, yeah.
So The Pigs is, it's kind of a conversation unlike any of the other ones that you have in the game, where she has... She's like a truly just a crazy woman that you find kind of on a boardwalk somewhere, and you have to do it at like 11 o'clock at night. Like, it's really late. And she has a like hand-cranked police siren on her back, and she's cranking it, and it's doing the like, you know, the kind of police thing. And basically, she's like... She is titled herself The Pigs, and it's like she's yelling cop shit at you and pointing her gun at you, and it's a legitimately very scary confrontation, because like, not many people in this game has a gun, and she does, and she's pointing it at you and potentially gonna shoot you. Josh, how did your pigs confrontation go?
I honestly do not remember. I forgot most of what happened, except I feel I actually don't remember what happened at the end of this confrontation in my playthrough.
I find her really, really fascinating because I feel like we talked about earlier, the cops in this world exist very differently than the cops in our world, even though the game acknowledges the bad parts of the cops kind of as an idea. But the pigs feels like the most direct confrontation with our world cops, where basically it seems like her brain is broken and that has turned into her being like the stereotypical cop. And so she's pointing a gun at you and you like raise your hands and you're like, okay, easy. And she yells, he's pulling something out of his pockets. And like, you know, it's yeah. a very like, you know, she's going to do this. And then eventually you realize the gun isn't loaded and you can take it from her. And my half light was like, okay, time to fucking stomp her into the dirt. But I did not ultimately do that. And then she just kind of like, she just shuts down and is this like basically sad old woman suffering from dementia. And you can tell Titus about her and he will like take her in. And you kind of see that the union is acting as a sort of like what a law enforcement would ideally do, which is like helping very mentally ill people kind of like get along when they're not able to do it for themselves. But it's like, she's one of the most kind of elevated characters in the game in that she seems totally detached from reality. Wow. And it's very scary and very sad.
And you only get it doing the YMCA line?
Yeah, because you only meet her when Everard says, yeah, this is who has your gun. Go meet her there at 11 p.m.
Everard kind of shut down for me after a while. Like, every time I went back to check on him because I wouldn't do those signatures, like, he just kind of stopped being a character for me.
Yeah, it's a shame that I feel like I wish he had more to say to you.
Because I've never gotten the gun before. How does the shootout go differently if you've got the gun?
Well, you can also find Ruby's gun.
I had a gun, yeah.
So
I've never had a gun in the shootout. I've always just been like, someone else is going to handle this.
Yeah, well, to answer, I missed twice. So not great for me.
I killed one of them.
Okay, here, wait. Well, so are there any more wrap-up things you want to do with your weird, wacky characters before we go into the shootout?
The return of my favorite character, the East Inlandian repeater station lady. Just the old lady who likes talking on her CB radio. I think she's so cute. And when she came back, because I talked to her for a long time in the role-playing section in the abandoned commercial district, she shows back up in the church. And I just talked to her. I just thought she was cute, and I loved that. Other than that, no.
I did. It with the ravers, I very easily turned Egghead into a fascist, which I thought was kind of funny, where he yells at you. He's like, the people hold the power. And you're like, are you communist? And they're like, no, he just heard that somewhere. And so I was like, hey, man, immigrants are fucking up this country. And he's like, okay, I'm a fascist now. And then he just swapped immediately.
Can I confide in you that Egghead is the only thing I looked up how to do in this game? It's the only thing I consulted.
Oh, because he has that kind of like dialogue maze.
Yeah, and I
had to look that up too the first time.
Yeah, I was real sick of hearing his shit, and I just, the intrepid reporters at wiki.ign.com got me through that one, so God bless you all for that.
Okay, I feel like Ruby is before we get to the showdown, there's finding Ruby.
Yeah.
Did you have anything interesting happen here?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I went to the factory where she is. I instantly got the skill check that my game crashed.
Okay. Before finding the factory, I mean.
Oh, anything interesting? I mean, I did the interrogation and was like, God damn it, of course, it's a whole other person I got to track down. But
did you meet the kids who heard the radio in their head?
No. So the way I found her is Titus says, she went up the coast. I went up the coast, talked to the lady who's always washing clothes. She, like, did not really engage with me, so I went into my little shack, found the bullet, went and confronted her again about the bullet, And then she was like, she's further north. And then I went to the factory. Then okay. My game crashed.
There is another way. I think I did all that. But you can also... There are... Some of those kids playing outside are hearing... They say they basically heard the radio in their head. And it's like specifically Speed Freaks FM.
Yeah.
That the thing that Kim likes to listen to.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think it's because Ruby is like doing weird radio wave stuff. But I had an amazing and horrible interaction where I called Speed Freaks FM on the phone and Kim was like, please don't do this. And I was like, oh, I'm calling them. And so you call them, you ask if they can hear the radio in their head. They're like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. But then I just said a bunch of super fascist shit to them. The guy is like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, why would you call and say this? And he gets really mad at you. And I'm like, and one more thing, shout out to my best friend, police officer Kim Kitsuragi. And then you hang up and then you turn on the radio and it's just the Speed Freaks FM guy being like, fuck everyone. And specifically, fuck Kim Kitsuragi. And Kim gets so mad at you. He is. It's like it was really like this is the point of no return for him is he's like, wow. I cannot tell you how out of line that was, and it felt awful, but I also thought it was very funny that it was in the game.
Wow. No, I didn't get any of that. I went straight to the factory, got that skill check, no problem. Game crashed on me as soon as I got it. I was in the factory, pressed pause to save the game. The game crashed, and then I had to reload my save like 10 times trying to get the skill check again until I finally got it, because I failed it every other time, and I said, Rupee, you better be ready for me after that bullshit. I was fucking so mad.
Yeah, so what was the outcome?
Of Ruby?
Yeah.
She shot herself. Yeah, so I went in. I got to the confrontation. I got really deep in it, and I died. So I had to then come out, go all the way to Frit, buy a bunch of healing items, go back to get through it. And she gives you the down low on it. And that's where all the stuff where you like really find out like you're a corrupt cop starts poking its head, at least in my playthrough. Like, I had no clue that Harry was... Is it the drug trade he's involved in?
I don't know
if that's specified. I think it's just, like... And then they don't really clarify whether Ruby was right about that or not. Because yeah. I think there's some doubt on whether he's actually the enforcer for this guy, but she certainly seems to think so.
It totally fucks my Harry up. Like, my Harry is, like, really bummed about this whole revelation, which I thought was really interesting.
My conversation with her was very short, so tell me what you found out here.
Mine goes on forever. I mean, she tells her whole side of the story, which is basically, at one point, Classier is like, you know, Ruby came up with the idea to make it look like he had been hanged. Ruby deflates that. He's like, no. Like, it was weird how, despite Classier ostensibly being, like, fucked up on blow or whatever it is, was like... Once we were in that room, like, she was very clear-headed. She was like, tie the shower cord around his neck, make it look like, they say the word lividity a bunch, make it look like he was hung, so we can, like, you know, do this fake stage death or whatever. And then there's really no choice but to tell Ruby, like, the Hardy Boys sold her out and Classier sold her out, at least for me. Like, I could not go around that. I kind of wanted to. So I had to tell her, like, all your friends ratted on you. I finally broke her machine. She's telling, you know, I'm interrogating her about me being the can opener. And she's like, you're working with this dude. It sucks. You're awful. I'm so scared of you. And then she goes, fuck it, and shoots herself. And it was like the end of this like very long drawn out conversation that basically was like, whatever Ruby was supposed to be to this story, it just doesn't matter anymore. Like, she is gone for me. So, I mean, can you save her? I assume you can't, because there's a check. Yeah,
she can run away.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, and you can talk her out of it. I don't remember what check it is, but I did actually get it my first playthrough. I don't know if it's like a logic or like a rhetoric check or something.
I tried it, but and failed. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say. Basically, she just leaves. Like, she does not she does not continue being a character. She, like, either way, she kind of gets out of there.
Yeah, so for me, we put her body in the tent, checked out her magazines, read her journal, and then I took her gun, which probably, you know, shouldn't have done.
Yeah, and Kim, I think when you read her journal, Kim's kind of like, it really doesn't sound like she killed him.
Yeah. So in my playthrough, a completely unnecessary death that happened here.
Yeah. Well, and it really affects it affects Harry to the level where, like, I had the option of saying, it's like, when she kills herself, you can just be like, I'm done. And then, yeah. And I was like, what happens if you click that? And it's like, it is like the game over screen, and it just says cop quits the force. Holy and shit. So it's like, you can just like before. Fully give up.
Yeah. My Harry's like, was very dejected after all this. Like, I think when Kim tells you, like, you're a good cop, when you're reading your, like, cop notes or whatever, like, your cop stats, I think, like, Harry, he no longer can believe he was a good cop slash person after this. Like, there always seems to be, like, doubt. Like, I know I fucked up right before I lost my memory, but, like, look at my stats. I didn't kill that many people. And, like, after talking to Ruby, Harry's just like, I'm a monster. Who was I? And it's, like, it's heartbreaking. Especially the immediate scene you enter, which went so fucking terribly for me. My Harry is like, I feel for the dude.
Yeah, I think one of the things that this game does really well towards the end here is feeling kind of like, you're like, okay, the me before that I have amnesia and didn't remember, different person. Yeah. You know, like, I regret doing that, but I'm over it, and I'm playing a video game now, and I'm going to do it right. And, like, the difficulty of doing that just continues, and so by this point at the end, you kind of feel like, man, I tried so hard, and I'm still being the fuck-up cop.
Yeah.
It is, like, a really kind of devastating feeling.
I tried so hard, got so far, and in the end it didn't matter, you know, like Linkin Park said. No, I mean, I don't know, like, if it's worth getting too in the weeds about it, but, like, shit like that is the true-to-life addiction story. Like, that's not really a metaphor, that's how it goes. Like, I think, you know, a fault of people in recovery is thinking it overwrites your past, and it doesn't. Like, you don't get... There are ways in which you get to start anew, but it's mostly, like, you just have to learn to live alongside the bad shit you did and just, like, accept it for what it is. I don't do the 12 steps, but there is the step that is, like, make amends except for to the people for which it would hurt for you to reach out, or whatever the fuck, however they word it. And I think, like, that is something I'm not saying the game doesn't reckon with, because I think it's reckoning with here. It's something Harry never reckons with in my playthrough, is, like, just because he doesn't remember doesn't mean he's abstained, right? Like, he's not forgiven for what he can't remember. And I think, like, the Ruby section for me is the moment he realizes, like, just because I can't remember doesn't mean everyone forgot. And it's, like, crushing to him, which I think is, like, it'll be fascinating to see if the game handles that going forward, because, I mean, that's, like, the thing addicts have to learn is, like, how do you live with that slash carry on from it, which is, like, it's a huge moment in an addict's life, is, like, learning how to go on past it, because usually you're using because you can't get past it. Whether or not the game deals with that or not, I don't know. It'll be very fascinating to see if it does.
Well, if we want to talk about feeling bad, let's talk about the shootout. So you leave the place that Ruby was, you walk back to the town square, and finally this is something that Joyce actually warns you about if you talk enough to her, which is, she's like, the mercenaries hired by Wild Pines are not going to stand by for much longer, and they're just going to have a military tribunal where they kill all of the Union. And then you walk in, and it's like, that's happening. That is, they are already in the middle of it. Maddie, you said you'd never had a gun.
I've never had a gun. It has always been Harry walking in, holding up his hands, being like, everybody calm down, and then immediately getting, you know, socked.
Does it always... I've never done this, even though sometimes I've had a gun, sometimes haven't. I've never had it not go the worst that it can go, or almost. You it's a little hard to know what the different options are. There's someone who's done like a good breakdown, but like, I don't know. Have Maddie or Josh, have you experienced like success in parts of this at all?
I definitely did not.
I didn't know you could.
There are only a couple things that are like absolutely necessary to happen, which is like, you know, there's kind of a random person from the union who gets shot, but it doesn't have to be Titus or Elizabeth. You can kill the scab leader guy either with your gun if you pass a hand eye check, or in maybe the craziest option of the game, if you've been wearing the tie that talks to you, the Inland Empire tie, and you bought that blue liquid from the like idiot Doom Spiral friend, when you were about to get to the square, the tie is like, it's time. And then you basically make a Molotov out of it. And you can, instead of shooting the scab leader, you can throw it at him and like burn him to death.
Wow. Which is
holy shit, crazy. I didn't know that was an option. 10 out of 10 game.
And so it's like, if you do that, then Titus won't get shot. You can make Elizabeth live, but you always get shot. That is inevitable.
So my shit.
But for me, everyone always dies. Blake, what happened for you?
So my shit got all fucked up. I took a shot at the third scab guy that you've never seen before that shows up here.
Uh-huh.
With the long rifle.
Scary man.
Yeah, yeah. Missed him. Then I think I got shot in the arm, but I was able to turn around and shoot the scab leader.
Oh, nice.
Which knocks him down. At some point, Kim shoots and kills the third one that I missed.
Yeah.
Then the scab leader, who does not immediately die if you shoot him, he shoots you again. You fall and start to almost die. And then a whole bunch happens while you're kind of blacked out. You wake up for a moment and see Kim, who's trying to help you. The other one, the lady scab, is about to like point blank shoot his ass. You warn Kim, he turns around, kills her just in time, and then I black out. And then I wake up, and as I recall, Titus is maybe still alive. Yeah, Titus is alive. Maybe the lawyers died, but like Angus is dead. One or two of them ran off. I believe the guy, I'm sorry to put it this way, I can't remember his name, but they always just call him the fat guy.
Yeah.
He's dead. Yeah. He's dead. There's a lot of bloodshed, basically. But I think, like, we killed the three scab leaders. I killed at least one of them.
No, that went pretty well for you.
That's a good outcome.
I think Elizabeth dying is, like, the only bad outcome.
I think she lived. I think she lived.
Oh, okay. I just put in the chat, and we can link this in the show notes, one of my favorite pieces of fan art ever is this thing that someone drew, which is Kim taking that shot, and you find out there's a line with Kim where you find out that they called his partner Eyes, like his former partner, because he had to, like, his partner had to help Kim see things because Kim's vision is so bad. And so then here is this fan art of like Eyes, Kim's former partner, like helping him aim and hit that other mercenary, and it's the coolest shit in the world. When you warned Kim that someone was about to shoot him, did you pay attention to the modifiers on that roll?
No.
Because they're, so it says, you know, it's like, you kind of regain consciousness, it says turn around, and then it has some of the most impactful writing in the game, which is like, it's an authority check, but then it says, if you're playing the game well, it'll say +1, Kim trusts you, +2, Kim really trusts you. And you read that and you're like, I did it. And it's in so my case, upsetting. Of course, I had -2 because Kim fucking hated me.
Oh, no, I didn't see that. No, I was so caught up in the moment. My partner was sitting next to me while I was playing this. We were both like freaking out in this moment, so I was just like clicking through, just like desperate, realized the game doesn't work that way. I could have taken my time, but I was just like,
it's really good, this whole scene, at making you feel like you're in that set of urgent situations, despite the fact that it's text. I think that it uses exactly what it has, that scroll of text and the screen going black and the music. It uses it perfectly.
Yeah, it was like smashing buttons the second text would appear, just trying to like desperately get through it.
I have kind of often wondered, you know, if you're going to make a game with violence in it, like what would a game be like where there's like one fight in the game, you know, where it's like it's not a game where you're shooting, but you do have a gun and you do shoot someone. And it's like, this is that where it's like there is a one scene of actual violence. And because it's like you found other dead people and you know that that exists. But like it feels so intense. And I truly, like, I felt so bad after the first time when, like, Titus died and, you know, the Mercs died. It was like, I almost had trouble continuing to play because I just felt like I had, like, fucked up the game so bad. Which is, like, I think exactly what it wants you to be feeling.
Yeah. That's the place they want you in.
Yeah. Blake, I'm going to tell you something that you are not going to believe, but I swear it's true. If you fail the check to get Kim to turn around, or if you don't warn him, Kim does get shot. He doesn't die, but he is absent for the rest of the game. And instead, your partner for the rest of the game is Kuno.
Are you kidding me?
I am not kidding.
I would fucking chuck my Nintendo Switch off the goddamn Brooklyn Bridge if I had to do
I
that.
Have never done a Kuno run before, but I am doing this time.
Oh my god, why? How? What is the setup that it's like?
He just shows up and he's like, "All right, cop, I'll help you.
We're hanging out now. I'm your best friend."
Crazy. Oh, I hate that little fucker so much. I did end up talking to Kuno and learning about Kuno S finally. Where you have the little whisper conversation with him. Good stuff. That sucks, Jacob. I'm sorry you got to deal with that for the next several hours.
I cannot wait. Because I know what's happening in the rest of the game, and I cannot imagine how Kuno is going to respond.
Yeah, that's gonna be fun.
That's crazy.
That's it. We're done. The next time on the podcast, we will be covering through the end of the game. We're going to finish it. We're gonna talk about everything. Maddie, Josh, thank you so much both for coming on and talking about Disco Elysium with us. Maddie, what would you like to plug? And then we can let you go.
Yeah, you can find me writing at Unwinnable every month. And I'm on the site formerly known as Twitter at All Palaces. That's about it.
Hell yeah. And Josh, how about you?
Yeah, check out Bad End Podcast and Super Culture Network.
That's it. You heard it here. Thank you both very much for coming on the show. Next time, we're wrapping this thing up, baby. He is the Infernal Engine. He never stops. He only gets worse. Thank you all for listening. Bye.